The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Now, from Ukraine to the Middle East, the United Nations is facing criticism for failing to stop major conflicts, and it was built, of course, to stop future wars. Many say it's outdated. So is it fit for purpose? To discuss this, I'm joined now by Dominic Waghorn, who is the Sky News International Affairs Editor. Hello, Dominic.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you very much for being with us. I think probably we need to go back, don't we, and talk about why the United Nations was established. It came after the two world wars, didn't it?
It did, yeah. And I think, you know, this is a question that I get asked probably amongst the most questions, which is, what's the point of the UN anymore? Does it, you know, does it do any good, and does it have any teeth? And you're right. You have to sort of go back to its origins and remind yourselves that it was set up in the wake, the aftermath of World War II. I've got the UN Charter in front of me, and that was the charter that was adopted by 50 nations, and then one more, Poland, joined a year or so later, back in 1945. And in black and white, it kind of states that it's the mission statement for the UN. It says, we the peoples of the United Nations determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights and the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women and nations, large and small, and so on. So it goes on. So it's basically, yeah, it was set up by the world so that World War II and World War I can never happen again. But also some of the things that the world had agreed on, like international law and new laws against crimes against humanity, the sort of agreed on principles and systems to make sure that those laws were imposed. And it's part of that kind of post-war setup that was designed to mean that the tragedy and trauma that the 20th century had meant for so many millions of people could not be repeated. And the problem is, I think, you know, we see it as a kind of world government, as a world authority, and that's a misunderstanding. It's a club of nations, and it has advantages and disadvantages, like all clubs do.
And it's now a very big club, isn't it? And part of the problem with it arises from the fact that there are so many members. And we'll talk about the more fundamental problem of those at the top of the tree not agreeing. But just talk to me about the membership first.
Yeah, that's right. So it started off with 51 nations, and it was basically set up, obviously, by the victors of World War II. So at the top of it is the UN Security Council, China, Russia, France, Germany, Britain and America, obviously not the vanquished in World War II, Germany and Japan, and none of the developing nations either. But it's swelled to this much bigger, much more unwieldy organization now of 193 nations. And I go to Manhattan, to New York every year for the UN General Assembly, which is a couple of weeks where New York comes to a grinding halt because 193 world leaders and all their diplomats arrive and their motorcades, you know, bring the place to a halt. But every year we hear the same calls, which this organization's just got too big. It needs to be reformed. Nothing actually ever happens. You know, one person described trying to get changes to the UN like herding cats, and it's got so big, and it's kind of like a Tower of Babel and just a talking shop. Now, clubs work really well if everyone agrees on something, and it has a force multiplier effect. So if the whole world agrees that climate change, for instance, is a problem, and the entire membership of that 193-nation club focuses on dealing with it, then obviously it can be very effective. The challenge really is galvanizing it into united, coordinated action. And that's been a fundamental problem for the last couple of decades, at least.
And let's talk about the Security Council then, and the five permanent members. As you say, a club is easy to run if everybody agrees. But if you have these five permanent members at loggerheads, you're going to have real problems. And we've seen all of that come to pass in the last 20 years or so, particularly.
Yeah, we have. Yeah. So if you think about it as a sort of club, at the top of that club, there's this committee. And the committee is made up of five permanent members, those countries I listed, and then 10 temporary members who sort of get it for every 2 years. Now, the permanent members aren't just permanent, but they also have a right of veto. And they can use that to block anything. So you have resolutions at the UN. The UN General Assembly resolutions are not binding. They're kind of recommendations. But the resolutions from the UN Security Council are binding. If you break those resolutions, then you are breaking international law. Now, that would be very effective if those five nations could agree. But it's a bit like having a club where one member has gone rogue, is attacking the neighbours, continuing to do so, despite everyone in the club saying it's not a good thing to do. Another member has just decided to rip up the rule book and to attack Iran in alliance with only one other member. And then the other member, China, is hoping to do the same thing at some point in the future against Taiwan. So, you know, that's the problem here. You've got at least three nations who've kind of ripped up the rule book that went along with the foundation of the UN, which is the idea that might cannot be proven right, that, you know, unprovoked aggression cannot be rewarded. And if you've got those three nations doing that, then that's an issue. And it really, as you say, goes back 20 years or so when Russia decided to help Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and basically decided cynically that it would use its position on the Security Council to block any investigation into Assad using chemical weapons. That has set a precedent, and it's a precedent that Donald Trump, who has a lot of impatience with the UN, has eagerly kind of decided to follow.
Mm-hmm. And it's easy, isn't it, sometimes to dismiss Donald Trump's criticisms as being Trumpian. But he does have a point in some regard when it comes to the UN, doesn't he? I mean, there are anomalies there in how it is run that would make any reasonable person look at it and go, well, it does need to be reformed, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think people who aren't sort of, you know, don't follow the UN very closely would be surprised to hear that Iran, which is a regime that egregiously breaches human rights in its own country, against homosexuals, against minorities, against anybody who is a dissident against the government, has been the chair of the UN Human Rights Council. Mm-hmm. And there are kind of, you know, numerous examples of that. And that's the issue on the right of American politics that kind of supports Donald Trump's reservations about the UN. But I think his reservation is a couple of things. It's ideological. He doesn't like the idea that America could be told to do anything by a club. But also personally, he's a narcissistic, vain man who does not like the idea of others having authority over him. So for all those reasons, he's opposed to this. He also doesn't really believe in the kind of ideas behind the UN and the post-war world order, which is basically if all countries get together, everyone benefits. His sort of worldview comes, I think, from the real estate background of New York, where he comes from, where if you do a deal, one person does well, the other one is worse off. And he seems to think that these organizations, not just the UN, but NATO and others, are basically ripping off America. So for all those reasons, he's very much opposed to the UN. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of compounding the problems that Russia have caused the organization and China may well do in the future.
So he set up this, or tried to set up this Board of Peace. I mean, it hasn't really managed to get off the ground, but essentially he sees that as the new and improved version of the United Nations, one that Donald Trump thinks might actually work.
That's a very good point, Claire. Exactly, yeah. So he's not only opposed and not funding and getting in the way of the UN achieving things, he's also, as you say, setting up this kind of rival organisation, the Board of Peace, which he set up to try and make the peace deal in Gaza be implemented effectively. And lots of countries kind of willingly signed up to that. They're countries who all expect to get favours from Donald Trump in return. It's kind of rather murkily financed. It's not quite sure where the billions of dollars pledged to it are going to end up. Could they actually end up in Donald Trump's pocket or sort of help him politically? Some allegations to that effect. But I think the fundamental problem with it is it actually hasn't done much to help implement anything in Gaza. The Gaza peace deal has led to this sort of pickling, if you like. It's stuck in a kind of stasis, a kind of limbo. Mm-hmm. And that is actually disastrous for the people of Gaza, because, you know, the reports we're now getting of medical, humanitarian, massive problems in Gaza. And that's another point I think about the UN. What it's not good at is actually forcing peace to end wars. What it is very good at is humanitarian missions, and it's not able to do that job in Gaza anymore because of the situation and because of what Donald Trump has done there in particular.
So in general, I mean, aside from the humanitarian work, which it does very successfully, there are those who would say it didn't manage to do that in Gaza, but that was for other and very complex reasons. But in general terms, it has been very successful in its humanitarian efforts. But beyond that, its wider remit, is it fit for purpose in 2026?
It's certainly not fit for the purpose it was designed, the job it was designed to do back in the 40s. And it's fallen well short of that. But it has, yeah, it's certainly fulfilled a humanitarian mission. Its critics would say it's sort of lumbering and bureaucratic. If you see it in effect in the field, it is enormous, and there are issues with that. But it has so much. Once that kind of geopolitical power is focused in a humanitarian direction, it can be very effective. I think the bottom line, Claire, you know, the reason I would not disband the UN, and there are those who say we should, is I think it represents really the high watermark of global cooperation, of that very noble ambition that the world getting together can stop bad things happening and can make good things happen. Mm-hmm. And even though it's kind of falling well short of that, the fact that it still exists gives us all something to rise to. And I think, you know, in the hands of better stewards in the Security Council in a different time, it could do a much better job. There is also the possibility of reforming it. There's no reason that Britain, for instance, has to have a permanent seat on this committee running the UN, you know, so many years after World War II. We could probably step aside from that, maybe see, you know, developing nation, India or Brazil, take our place. You know, that's going to be very hard to make it happen. But there will be reform, there will be changes. And I think eventually the UN should be given a chance to live up to those very noble ambitions back in 1945.
That might be a very bitter pill for some of those in Britain to swallow. But let's see what happens. Dominic, thank you so much for your time. Dominic Waghorn there, International Affairs Editor with Sky News.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.